scatter across that acre of property a whole bunch of Yagi-like antennas aimed straight up. This great big phased array of antennas had a ridiculous amount of gain, quite a bit of bandwidth, and it's being fed with a transmitter that could transmit millions of watts of power. Okay, so what Hawk did is aim a whole lot of power with a whole lot of antenna gain, essentially straight up, although the array could be electronically steered. It didn't have to, the signal coming out of it didn't have to always go straight up. It could go left, right, forward, back, so to speak, from being straight up. But the phased array was on the ground, and each individual element, each individual Yagi of this hundreds of Yagis on the ground were aimed straight up. And so by transmitting a strong enough power at a frequency like 430 megacycles, I'm not sure the exact frequency they used, you could ionize the air above you. In other words, you made an artificial ionization by transmitting a whole lot of power through that ozone layer. And once you ionize that ozone layer, let's assume now that I did this in the center of the United States, in the Chicago area, and I got somebody that wants to transmit a secure piece of information from Maine to California. And so by ionizing the air directly above Chicago, I'm making this up, and I may be a little bit in error here, but you ionize the ionosphere above Chicago, the guy in Maine aims his signal at that ionized layer above Chicago that may be 60 kilometers up. The signal reflects off the ionized layer, goes over to the other receiving site in California.
Repeater, time out.
Under normal circumstances, that signal in my crazy example from Maine to California wouldn't get there. By way of this artificial ionization created by the transmitter in Chicago, you've now opened up the path. You've created the method by which propagation can take place. And once, and this is all coordinated, and once the site in Maine finishes communicating with California, the HOP installation in Chicago, in my example, turns off the transmitter. A few seconds later, the ionization goes away, and the path is no longer there. So you open the door when you need it to communicate, and then you close the door when you don't need it anymore, if you know what I mean. So artificially, you create ionization. The sun does it all the time, from time to time. A blast of solar particles and the solar wind comes out of the sun. It hits the ionosphere, creates ionization. And all of a sudden, we've got sporadic E and other kinds of great propagation that we amateurs study. 99% of the time, the sun does that for us. Well, Mother Nature can sometimes be aided by mankind with pieces of hardware like this. So there were a few of these HOP installations scattered around the world for both an experiment and for probably real use from time to time, if you know what I mean. So that's part of what's going on. Let me drop. There were people who lived a couple of miles away from a HOP installation, and they thought they're being harmed by radio frequency biohazard. The chances of that are less than 1 in 1,000,000. By that I mean the signal was being aimed straight up, not out to the side where the people lived. On top of that, 99% of all of the fear that people have are radio frequency biohazard. Those fears are 99% of the time unfounded. You take, for instance, the 2 or 3,000 residents in the village of Bayville, Long Island, in the township of Oyster Bay. In that town of Bayville, there's a very charismatic person who has developed an opinion that all radio transmissions are dangerous. So he has convinced a majority of the residents of the town or the village of Bayville that they should campaign to remove all antennas from the town. There's a website that used to be called BRAC, B-R-A-C, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. They wanted all the cell towers removed. They wanted all the police antennas removed. They wanted all the fire department antennas removed. They wanted all the emergency services for ambulance. They wanted all of those antennas removed from their village and placed in some other town. And if they really believed that the antennas were harmful, what was their thinking about the people in the other town? But they wanted the antennas placed somewhere else. And they had multiple lawsuits to do that. And these people were fairly sincere. They would think they were protecting their children. The people in that town would not use their microwave oven. use their cell phone with the children in the house. Even the wireless dongle that's connected to their laptop computer, they would not turn that on when the child was in the house for fear of irradiating the child with microwave radiation. Let me drop. Now, these are sincere people who really wanted to protect their children, but technologically speaking, they're very much in error. The problem they have is a problem of vocabulary. Back in 1900, when scientists were studying radio antennas, they discovered that the signal comes out of the radio antenna and it goes out in all directions. The signal radiates. So the process of sending a signal out from an antenna is called radiation. Radio frequency radiation, RF radiation. Perfectly good word. Until World War II came along, and all of a sudden we had nuclear radiation. And the relationship between nuclear and radio radiation is essentially zero. Nuclear radiation has a subatomic particles that are, or atomic level size particles that are like bullets that come out of there at near the speed of light. And when those atomic bullets hit your body, they are capable of doing damage. Radio doesn't have those bullets. The 60 years of studying of the American National Standard Institute, and you can read it in the C95 report. You go over those words, C95 report, American National Standards Institute, and it's a complicated document, but it represents 60 years of research, about 1,000 references. It represents the best experiments and the best laboratories and the best institutions and the best colleges of radio research and what they've discovered. Let me drop. What they discovered is that when a radio wave strikes a human being, for instance, it does nothing but create some heating. And so how much heating are you getting from that cell site that might be next door to your house? The radio emission from that cell site at drive time is approximately the same amount of heating power as a 35-watt incandescent light bulb. If you think you're protecting yourself from radio frequency biohazard when you order that the cell site not be put in your town, you're ordering that the people protect you from the heat coming off a 35-watt incandescent light bulb, and I'm not kidding. On top of that, the cell site against your head, which is a quarter of an inch away, is giving you an amount of radio energy inside your body that is 1 million times greater than if you live directly next door to the cell site base station because of the inverse square law. All of this is misunderstood. So the people of Bayville want that cell site, which happens to be right across the street from the grade school. They want that removed because they think it is damaging the children in that grade school. Unfortunately, there was a child in the grade school that developed leukemia. There was a teacher in the school that developed cancer. And the residents of the town said, aha, those antennas on the water tower that's across from the school, that's what did it. We got to get them all removed. Logical sounding, dead wrong. I mean, they think they want those antennas removed. If in the worst case, let me drop.
SM-N1-YDY.
YDY recognized. If in the worst case, a child out of that school went across the street, climbed over the fence, climbed up the leg of the water tower, climbed under the top of the water tower, walked over to those cell site antennas on the water tower, kneeled in front of that cell site antenna, 5 feet away from it, stared directly into the antenna at drive time when everybody is driving their automobiles and using the cell site. That child will, believe it or not, by the American standard and also by the European standard, that child would be safe. Until he moved into 3 feet in front of the antenna, he would then cross the threshold of maximum permitted exposure. You'd have to be 3 feet away from the antenna at drive time, staring straight into it for 6 solid minutes with his eyes open before he would be at the threshold of potentially creating damage, and even that threshold has got some safety factors built into it. So 300 feet away, 200 feet down lower in altitude in the school with the inverse square law, are those children safe? Probably by more than a million to one, if you know what I mean. And what what Victoria Siegel, the mayor of the town, did a few years ago, she hired a well-documented research organization to come and make measurements in that town and published a report called the Park Report. And the Park Report had some good news and some bad news. The good news is that all the antennas on the water tower are safe as all hell. The bad news is they discovered that the the law enforcement antennas were inadequate. There were places in the town where the law enforcement antennas, let me drop. Places in the town where the law enforcement antennas are not giving coverage. As such, people in law enforcement must memorize the places in the town where they can't call for backup because there is no radio coverage. And they're not allowed to add any more of those antennas because the townspeople are so much against it. It's a very ridiculous situation. And I have some relatives in that town, and I tried talking to them. And my goodness, it's a tough talk. Mr. YDY, go right ahead with your information, sir. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, good evening, and good evening to everybody else. I'm sure you remember my name is Hank. My question was, isn't there something about whole-body resonance at these 800 megahertz frequencies that a lot of the cell phones use that have to be taken into account for the potential of harm to a child?
A good guess, Hank. No, absolutely not. The guys who run radio control model airplanes, who used to use the 70 megacycle region with their whip antennas coming out of the radio control transmitters, what they did discover is that a human being standing straight up above ground does have a minor kind of first resonance at roughly 70 megacycles. You're holding on to that radio control transmitter with the whip antenna coming out of it, and you turn your body backwards so that you're now facing away from your airplane, and you would think you would have lack of coverage. It turns out that that whip antenna, that transmitter in your hand, is the probe that excites your body, and a significant amount of the energy at 70 megacycles is being radiated by the first level of resonance of the length of your body. Up at 800 megacycles, does a human being have resonance? Absolutely not. When you study the American National Standard Institute standard, the C95, you'll see that it's got this bathtub-shaped curve of what amount of milliwatts per square centimeter you're allowed to irradiate a human being with. And the most dangerous region, the bottom of the bathtub curve of maximum permitted exposure, is the frequency region between 30 and 300 megacycles, the so-called VHF frequency region. In that frequency region, 30 to 300, because of the way the protoplasm of a human being is constructed. Let me drop. And by the way, Eric is making some changes. That's why my voice has got that hollow sound to it. 30 to 300 is where a high percentage of the radio energy hitting a human being gets absorbed and converted into heat. And whether or not you've exceeded the maximum permitted exposure is strictly a function of the amount of heating created. Can it create an excessive amount of heating that that portion of the body cannot tolerate? The most sensitive portion of the human body is the cornea of your eye. So if your eye is open, your eyelid is open, you're staring straight into it, the radio energy hitting your eye, heating your cornea, could potentially give you a cataract if you exceed by a whole lot. You exceed 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. That was experimented by irradiating a rabbit. That's what the National Bureau of Standards did way back in the dark ages of 1960 or so. They found out how much RF energy is required to be squirted into the eye of a rabbit before the rabbit develops a cataract. And it was somewhere above 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. And so the current standard, you're not allowed to exceed 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. You could say we got 100-to-1 safety factor built into it. So 30 to 300 is the most dangerous region because you absorb. When you go to 1,500 megacycles and above, the so-called microwave region, it becomes 5-to-1 safer because at those frequency regions, 20% of the energy is absorbed, 80% is reflected off of your skin, doesn't get absorbed at all. Below 30 megacycles, the RF energy doesn't even react per se with the body. It just passes right straight through. So the frequency is like 3.5 megacycles. 90-some-odd% of the energy doesn't even interact with the human being. It just passes right through. So if you take the frequency region of that curve that I'm describing, let me drive. And you divide that frequency region into three sections, low, medium, and high. Low meaning below 30 megs, medium being 30 to 300, and high being above 300 megahertz. I call those three regions through you, in you, and off you. Below 30 megacycles, the majority of the energy goes through you and does nothing. 30 to 300, it goes in you, gets absorbed, and turned into heat. Above 300, most of it starts reflecting off of you. So RF energy, we've been looking for 60 solid years with all of that research for the non-thermal effect. People used to believe that the RF energy would be absorbed by the nerves of your body as if they're coax cables, turned into electrical signal, and the electrical signal will do something. They've been looking for the non-thermal effect for 60 years. They can't find it. They found nothing but the thermal effect. So you can easily calculate the amount of heating the radio energy comes, creates, and that's why the maximum permitted exposure by way of total body absorption, or is what it's called now, watts per cubic centimeter, so to speak, is the way the cell phones are rated. You can go to a website. Let me drop. You can go to a website where they list all of the brands and all the model numbers of the cell phones, and they tell you the number of the letters that are used for it, but it really means total body absorption, watts per cubic centimeter. And you can look at the ratings of each of the cell phones. And you could use the one with the lowest ratings if you want. You're wasting your time if you do that, because the cell phones now have an antenna that's built inside, because we all insist on that. The antenna is in such a terrible environment, the antenna has no antenna pattern. It's almost an isotropic radiator. If you looked at a three-dimensional pattern coming out of an antenna out of your cell phone, it would look like an apple. There's a little bit of a null in one direction where the stem of the apple is, and everywhere in every other direction it's radiating. So when you choose an antenna with lower amounts of RF energy coming out of it, lower amount of heating characteristic, you're choosing the cell phone with the lower power of output. Simple as that. And therefore you're going to have more dropouts and smaller range. So you think you're protecting yourself from that. It's kind of silly. Back to you, Hank. I probably went left of center of your question. Mr. Whitey White, KQRIW.
Oh, Dick, you answered everything I had to ask. I was just curious. I'd read the term, and I was wondering if, as I understood it, if it applied to cell phone frequencies. But thanks again for your usual thorough and excellent explanation.
Hey, that guy Hank has got good taste. Now, one of the most ridiculous situations I know of, this was in the Journal of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE a year or two ago. There was a situation that happened in France where a cell site was put up alongside of an apartment building. And the people in the apartment building started developing all kinds of health effects. They had trouble concentrating. They were getting headaches. They were getting nauseous and whatever. And so they started putting tinfoil on the windows, and they started doing all kinds of protection things, and they started a couple of lawsuits. They wanted that cell site removed. And all those lawsuits finally got into the court in Reims, France, and the judge there said, there is no evidence that the cell site is creating any damage, but where so many people are being fed, led to feel uncomfortable, and they're developing what they believe are health effects. Just to solve the situation, the court ordered the cell site to be removed. The people who were removing the cell site got interviewed, and they found out, hey, this is crazy. Yes, we installed the cell site tower. We hadn't yet installed the antennas on it. It wasn't yet operational, and now we're being ordered to remove it because people had all of these health effects. What a case that is. That gives you some indication of how psychosomatic illnesses, how bad they can get when you get a whole apartment building worth of people telling each other how sick they're going to become because of that cell site, or how sick that they already are because of that cell site, and they believed it. What a case. I know, again, we've gone very far left of center, but I hope we've given some information here that's useful, John. Let's see now. The original question. What did James ask as the original question?
Repeater, time out.
You may have to repeat the question again to me, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, you can never get enough of this information.
public, but that's for sure. His question was the purpose of HARP, you know, how it was used, at which you did that, and also some of the conspiracy stuff that went along with it. There was so many stories of what they were trying to do with that. It was just crazy stuff. Back to you, Dick. Yeah, there have been stories of people who think that HARP is trying to do mind control. They think of the radar out at Montauk Point, Long Island, the so-called FPS-35 radar that was part of the Air Defense Deprecation Zone. My company, Airborne Instrument Laboratory, used to work for, manufactured some of the electronics that went into that radar. It was, the main project was by Sperry Gyroscope Company, Sperry Electronics, Lake Success, where they were at the time. Beautiful, great big antenna out there, 135 feet wide, which still stands. It's a national monument. Some people want to make sure it becomes a monument because it's a beautiful thing. It's like, if you like great big antennas on top of a six-story building out at Camp Hero at Montauk Point. So people thought it was doing mind control, doing artificial intelligence, some kind of a clairvoyance by which you could monitor people's thoughts with these things. Oh, they come up with all kinds of stories. If you don't understand wireless equipment, if you don't understand radio, and if you think it has all kinds of other magic properties to it, and the non-thermal effects are going to be tapping into people's brains, you can make up all kinds of stories like that. And you probably can, if you make them exciting enough, you can get them published, and a certain percentage of the public reading those stories will say, yeah, verily, that's true. You can be convinced that it's the accurate thing, if you know what I mean. So, HARP was nowhere near as dangerous as people think. It was nowhere near as insidious as you think. It was a beautiful science experiment of artificially heating and artificially creating an ionosphere for reasons of enhancing certain kinds of radio propagation. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet. Yeah, very good, Dick. I think that completes that. And you can put that in with the people who've been kidnapped by aliens. A lot of that stuff goes along with it. Okay, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next question.
Be careful with those alien abductions. Maybe the vast majority of them are kooks, are reports of people that are kooks. But when it comes to objects that people, that very qualified people see in the sky, which sometimes show up on radar and other things, the fact that there are things in the sky that are hard to explain, it's very easy to say, all these people are crazy and they're looking at swamp gas. Not necessarily. There are more and more articles, more and more books being written these days telling you that when very qualified people, and a whole lot of them, simultaneously see something in the sky that's very difficult to explain, for us to sit here and think that we're the only intelligence in this universe and no other visitors could have ever happened, for people to say that is a little bit too arrogant from my point of view. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, there I agree with you, Dick. Absolutely. There are probably people out there far advanced and have craft. They may have come here. There's so many things. I have seen them. You have seen them. Can't explain it. So something's going on there. Now, whether they're landing and abducting people, I don't go along with that. But they may be traveling through our atmosphere, and people have seen some very strange things along with myself. And you've seen some wild things, too. Yeah, difficult to explain. But as far as the other part, I don't think so. Let me let it drop. We'll pick up the next one. KC2WGB. Okay, got a wonderful question here from Roy. Now, you and I have spent a lot of time in front of a Vector Network Analyzer, so maybe you can help him out. He is questioning the factor of capacitance affecting the bandwidth of an antenna. So maybe you could help him out in what you've observed over the years and how that works. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If you go to college and study a good course on radio, electronic circuits, circuit design, you'll eventually come to the term called Q, the letter Q, Quebec, in other words. is a quality factor, that's why it's given the name Q. Quality factor, in the beginning it was used to measure the quantitative quality of a resonator system. If I take an inductor and a capacitor and put them across to each other, I end up with a resonant circuit. The circuit has a resonant frequency, but the formula is 1 over 2 pi square root of LC. L is inductance in Henry, C is capacitance in farads. Take the square root of it, multiply it by 2 pi, take 1 over it. Now you know the resonant frequency in hertz, and that should be a great big number, and you convert it back into megahertz or gigahertz, whatever units you like. So a circuit with an inductor and capacitor has a resonance characteristic. That resonance characteristic is very desirable when it comes to selecting the bandpass. In other words, if I'm building an RF amplifier for my radio, and I only want the frequencies around 146 megacycles to go into my radio, and I want all other frequencies to be rejected, let me drop. I choose an inductor and a capacitor of the right size that resonate at 146 megs. I put that in the front end between the antenna and the first amplifier. If I do it just right, only 146 megs and nearby frequencies get into my radio, and everything else gets rejected. And my radio is protected from a strong broadcast transmitter nearby that's at 700 megacycles, so to speak. So it's a good thing. And you're doing the same thing when it comes to the IF strip of the radio. You've got tuned circuits. So what kind of bandwidth you get out of that tuned circuit is measured by Q. The higher the Q, the more the restriction of bandwidth, the narrower the bandwidth. There's about five separate definitions of Q. One of the more popular definitions is center frequency divided by bandwidth. If I had a secret circuit that is tuned to 146 megacycles, that's the center frequency. If it had a bandwidth of 1 megahertz, a possible number, I divide the 1 into 146, and by definition, my circuit has a Q of 146. 146 megs divided by 1 meg of bandwidth, I've got a Q of 146. If my circuit had a Q that's twice as high, then it would only have half a meg of bandwidth instead of 1 meg of bandwidth. So, to some degree, the higher the Q, the better, 98% of the time. So, measuring Q is something very valuable. Q has got a few other definitions. Let me drop. I told you it's defined as center frequency divided by bandwidth. It's also defined as the voltage rise at resonance. It's also defined as the current rise at resonance. It's defined as the energy stored per cycle versus the energy dissipated per cycle. It's defined as rise time and the fall time of a resonant circuit, ring down time. 4 or 5 or 6 definitions of Q. They all are the exact same phenomena, just different ways of measuring it, different ways of describing it, different ways of trying to figure out what's going on. But in all cases, Q is usually very desirable. If I'm building a very high Q cavity resonator, I might be able to design one with a Q of 5,000. If I'm using a quartz crystal as a resonator in order to determine the crystal, the frequency of my transmitter, and if I take a state-of-the-art crystal, quartz crystal, mounted just right in a vacuum environment, you could get a Q as high as 1 million. If that 1 million Q crystal quartz oscillator was running at 10 megahertz, by the usual definition of Q, that circuit would have a bandwidth of 10 hertz. 10 hertz divided into 10 megahertz is a Q of 1 million. And so with a carefully designed, ovenized oscillator circuit running at 10 megacycles with a real good crystal in there, I could probably get the circuit to have less than 1 hertz of error at 10 megahertz as a frequency reference standard for my frequency counter or whatever. Let me drop. There is a rubidium standard and a cesium beam standard, which has Q even higher yet, probably in the multiple. Maybe if somebody told me that a cesium beam oscillator had a Q of 100 million, it wouldn't take very much time for him to convince me that's approximately what you could really measure. So IQ in many circumstances is very desirable. Okay? One of the ways that you as a circuit designer and analyzer can figure out what the Q of a circuit is to actually analyze the individual components. Let me drop. Depending on how you design or build the inductor the inductor always has a little bit of equivalent series resistance. Your capacitor has a little bit of equivalent series resistance. So if you're writing down a schematic diagram of your inductor and your capacitor, and you're putting together as a parallel resonator, and you plug in the resistor that's in series with the inductor, and the resistor that's in series with the capacitor, and now you analyze that, use the right equations, and you come up with what is the Q of that circuit. If you're really smart and you use wider diameter conductor for the inductor, and a better design of the capacitor, you can make the equivalent series resistors get to smaller and smaller numbers, and you get to higher and higher Q. Or you can also make an equivalent circuit where the resistor looks like a load resistor that's across the hold-on network. And by the way, you use the resonator, you really have an input coupling network from the antenna and an output coupling network to the rest of the receiver, and those tap points on that circuit also are a kind of external loading, which lowers down the circuit and lowers the Q. You can then go to a couple of very well-expected and respected formulas where if you know the ratio of Q loaded, Q unloaded, you know the exact insertion loss of the circuit. Let me run that by again. So you've got an inductor and a capacitor, a known performance of the inductor and the capacitor, and you connect them together, and you calculate the Q of that circuit before you add the antenna input connector and before you add the output connector going to the rest of the radio. That's the so-called unloaded Q. Now you add your antenna connection and you add your radio connection to that circuit, so it's now a real bandpass filter, and now the Q has been loaded, has lowered because of what you've done. So now once you know the ratio of Q loaded to Q unloaded, you now know what the right formula, exactly what is the insertion loss of that circuit. And so now you can trade off a light loading or heavy loading of your input and output circuit, which would give you a lot more insertion loss, however, a lot sharper tuning. So now there's a trade-off between how much you load down the circuit with your input and output connector, how much you change the bandwidth of the circuit, and you can play those two parameters against each other and come up with an ideal circuit. Or maybe you're going to then go the next step of not using one single resonator. You're going to use two separate resonators connected together as a filter network. Now you can, if you carry that far enough, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have just the right kind of bandpass characteristics you want, just the kind of tuning you want, and just the kind of loading you like, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Now, we as electronic engineers know how to calculate the Q of a resonator if people give us enough information about the quality of the capacitor and the inductor that's making the resonator. And so the very smart guy named Joe Rilla, the chief engineer of Airborne Instrument Laboratory, went around the laboratory one day and took a couple of his favorite electronic engineers and asked them this question. The question was, if I've got an LC network that has a known Q of, let's say, 100, and I have a second identical circuit which has a known Q of 100, so I've got two identical LC networks, what happens if I put the two of them in parallel? Boy, a bunch of us really had trouble with that one, because we knew that one of the definitions of Q is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. By putting two LC resonators in parallel with each other, we knew that we had doubled the number of capacitors present, we had doubled the number of inductors present, we had doubled the number of energy storing devices present, therefore the total amount of stored energy we knew had doubled. Therefore, it would be very easy to say, okay, you've just doubled the Q when you did that. The answer is no, not at all. Hidden within every single resonator, there is the equivalent of a parallel resistor, a series resistor, call it what you like. There is an equivalent resistor in every circuit. Unless the Q is infinity, there is a real resistor there. Your eye may not see it, it's there. And with the right kind of Q measuring instrumentation, vector network analyzer, whatever, you can measure what is the value of the real Q, the real resistor that is there, if you know what I mean. Let me drop.
Do we have a TMP done?
So what we all didn't realize at first, and by the way, the impedance doesn't change when you do that. That's another interesting situation. So what we all didn't realize is that, yes, we're doubling the number of stored energy devices when we put a pair of resonators in parallel, but we had also doubled the number of load resistors present. Therefore, each individual circuit had the exact same Q before and after the connection, and so the total amount of energy dissipated per cycle did double. The total amount of energy stored per cycle did double. The ratio didn't change. The Q of the circuit doesn't change when you put a pair of them in parallel. Assuming now that you're just studying the circuits in isolation and you haven't added yet the input network and the output network, life gets more complicated when you do that. So his original question was just these standalone LC networks, I'm putting a pair of them in parallel, what happened to the Q? The answer is nothing. Very few of us got that one right. He realized this conundrum is something that's easily understood. He worked around the laboratory, asked us, each one of us, that question. We all learned something by the process. Let me drop. Now, depending on how I set up the mathematics, you and I know that you've seen some of these step-by-step mathematical situations where you prove that 1 plus 1 is not 2. Or 2 plus 2 is not 4, you know what I mean? It becomes 5. There's ways you can set up mathematics that are very difficult to see what's going on. By the same token, I come up with mathematics where I add a capacitor to an antenna circuit, and you think you haven't changed the Q. And sometimes you haven't, sometimes you haven't. And on the subject of Q, I'm going to give you one other life experience of mine. Let me drop. And that is, everybody has been taught, it's been rammed into your head in electrical engineering skew, that high Q is desirable. So if you have the resources, do whatever you can to lower the resistance of the inductor and lower the resistance, series resistance equivalent of the capacitor in order to get high Q resonators, because high Q is desirable, because if you're using that circuit at all, you want frequency selectivity, and you only get high selectivity if you've got high Q. Everybody knows that high Q is desirable. And along comes the antenna design. Oh boy, and all things, all of a sudden the world breaks into something very different. In the case of a Yagi-like antenna, do you want the individual parasitic elements, your directors and capacitor, your directors and reflectors, do you want them to be high in Q or low in Q? Well, from one point of view, making them high in Q means they have very little loss. And when you're studying a director, a parasitic director or a parasitic reflector in isolation, do you want high Q? Yea, verily. But when you combine them into the Yagi-like structure, do you still want high Q? Now it's not so clear. In some cases, you want your antenna to cover a particular bandwidth. You don't want, when it comes to filtering, you do that as a separate process, and maybe your filter is tunable, or maybe you select a filter 1, filter 2, filter 3, depending on which portion of the band you're listening to right now. Some of the Yaesu early 2-meter receivers did that. They had a tracking filter in the front end, and the knob on the front end of the Yaesu 221R, as I remember, a 2-meter synthesized rig popular in the 80s. There was a click-click 8-selection switch depending on which portion of the 2-meter band you were listening to. One click covered 144 to 144.6, and the next click covered 145 to 146 and so on, or 145, 144 to 145, 144.6. 5 to 145.
Repeater, timeout.
By way of the tracking filter that was in the front end of the 221R transceiver, 2-meter all-mode transceiver, that was one of the more bulletproof rigs that 2-meters ever saw because of that tracking filter and filter selection characteristic of its front panel. So, you can do the filtering external to the antenna. The antenna itself, in many cases, it's difficult to make electronic changes in the antenna. Although nowadays, with modern-day circuits, I put a whole bunch of relays inside of that array of 16 Yagis. You go to that picture that's on the front cover of LimarkTechNet.com, and you see me standing in the middle of an array of 16 Yagis on 432. That array had a whole bunch of relays built into it so that I could feed that array all 16 Yagis at once, or one vertical string of those four Yagis, or the very top Yagi all by itself. I called it a zoom control. And the Yagi in three steps went from a 25-degree beam with antenna down to a 5-degree beam with antenna by clicking the switches of the relays that were in that array. So I put switching circuits in the middle of that phasing harness of that antenna, and I used that antenna for 4.5 years. It was the most fun antenna I ever had. Let me drop it. Using that antenna and a kilowatt transmitter, a power kilowatt strip line amplifier, April and May, QST magazine, using that combination, using nothing but the 432 meg band, where most guys develop the greatest amount of score during a VHF contest by the zillions of contacts they make on 6 meters with band openings, 2 meters, and 1296. I used nothing but the 432 band and rejected all the other bands because I was having such long-range, great contacts with that antenna. And on 3 occasions, I won the contest for the New York, for the W2 area, the New Jersey, New York area. I won the contest using nothing but 432 and that antenna. Boy, was that a fun antenna to use. So tuning the antenna itself is something you can do if you've got the right equipment, if you've got the right attitude about it. But here's my next point. When it comes to making an antenna, do you want the Q to be high, which means it has very little loss? In the case of a resonator, a low Q resonator has a lot of lossy elements in it. In the case of an antenna, if you're smart enough in the way you design the antenna can have a lot of bandwidth, a lot of apparent low Q, but it isn't due to loss. It's due to other phenomena. So what I managed to discover way back in 2002, 2003, is if you take wide sheets of copper to build a Yagi-like structure, a three-element Yagi-like structure at 915 megacycles, and if you do it just right, you can make the widest antenna in the world, the lowest Q antenna in the world, which has a standing wave ratio of 1.05 to 1, not at just one frequency, inclusive across the frequency region of 902 to 928 megs, a 3% bandwidth. The VizWire is something like 1.05 to 1, 25 or 30 decibels of reflection coefficient, that lower standing wave ratio. If you set it up just right with wide pieces of copper, that antenna ran at 98% efficiency. You put a lot of power into it, and 0.99 watts got radiated into space. It's got low Q, broad bandwidth, but high performance. You needed that antenna to make a very good radio frequency identification device handheld reader. You had to cover that frequency region. You had to cover that frequency region with very low standing wave ratio so that the reflection from your antenna didn't jam your own receiver. Because the way RFID readers work, if this was the best of all worlds, you'd have one antenna that does the transmitting, another antenna 5 feet away that does the receiving. Well, think about that. If it's a handheld device, do you want the two antennas side by side to be 5 feet apart? Hell no. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm double checking. Okay, we still got the Eastern Link. Because you want to handhold the whole device, the same antenna has to do the transmitting and receiving. It is a CW radar. In the case of the antenna you're listening to right now on the top of the building that's doing the transmitting for this repeater, one single antenna is transmitting and receiving. And you've got an extremely high Q filter network of either 4 or 6 cavities. Each one has a Q of 5,000. Selecting the difference between the transmit frequency and the receiver frequency that are 600 KC apart by way of that very elaborate filter. This transmitter can put out 70 watts on transmit and have a fraction of a microvolt of sensitivity on receive, even though it's using the exact same antenna for transmitting and receiving simultaneously. And you can get away with that because there's 600 KC of offset in frequency between transmit and receive, and you've got this very fancy filter passing the transmit frequencies to the antenna, rejecting the receive frequencies. Alongside of it, you've got another set of cavities acting as the receiver filter, passing the receiver frequency in from the antenna back into the receiver, and not allowing the transmitter to come in. And the separation because of that filter between transmit and receiver is something like 120 decibels of separation by way of that filter. Let me drop. In the case of a handheld reader for an RFID environment, the transmit frequency and the receiver frequency are the absolutely identical frequency. No offset. No way in hell can you filter that. There ain't no filter that'll pass 0 hertz of difference between the transmit and receive. Therefore, you've got to make the world's best antenna, which has very little reflection from the antenna. So if the reflection from your antenna, when you're transmitting, doesn't jam your receiver. You want to listen to the echo off of the RFID tag, which is on the exact same frequency you transmit to, and it reflects back and receives to you, and it pulses on and off to give you the code of that tag, and you have to be able to read that. So it's a CW radar with one antenna. And until you make that antenna that high in quality, 1.05 standing wave ratio, that system will not fly. You go out to any antenna manufacturer, and you give him that as a set of requirements for the antenna. 1.05 standing wave ratio across 902 to 928 megacycles, and every single one of them will know bid, and they'll tell you, you're crazy. It can't be done. Well, we did it, and we patented it, and it works like a charm, and it's been in manufacture now for approximately 10 years. Very successful product. It can be done. So there's extremely low Q. Where's that low Q coming from? That antenna exceeds all of the previous formulas that were very well respected. For the volume of the antenna, what is the bandwidth you can get out of the antenna, is dictated by a set of formulas formed in 1947 by Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler. Harold Wheeler and Mr. Chu wrote two separate articles saying, this is the volume of the antenna, this is the bandwidth you can get out of the antenna. That antenna exceeds the Chu-Wheeler criteria. If you're adding a tuning network to the antenna to give you impedance matching, you have
repeater timeout.
You can add a tuning network between your electronics and the antenna as an impedance matching device, and the Bode-Fano criteria will tell you what's the maximum bandwidth you can get out of that system because of the best inductors and capacitors you've added to that tuning network of the antenna. We exceed the Bode-Fano criteria. And the first time you hear this, we've exceeded Chu-Wheeler, and we've exceeded both Bode-Fano. The average person will say, you guys are crazy. You've made bad measurements. You can't possibly do that. No one's ever done that. Well, are they right or are we right? The answer is both. Because the Chu-Wheeler criteria and the Bode-Fano criteria are based on fixed components. If the equivalent inductor and the equivalent capacitor of your antenna is fixed versus frequency, if all of the capacitor values and inductor values in your impedance match network are fixed in value versus frequency, then those formulas and those criteria are absolutely the truth. But if you're smart enough in the way you design the antenna with wide pieces of copper and the impedance matching network, if you do it just right, you have inductors and capacitors that are not fixed in value versus frequency. It's got a self-compensating characteristic to it. By way of the formulas, by way of the computer modeling programs, you would never find that. You take a real tinkering ham radio philosophy guy sitting in front of a Rodenschwartz vector network analyzer, and he's laying down wide pieces of copper tape on a piece of film, and he's doing tuning by putting pieces of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick, and he's holding it near circuits. He's holding it near the circuit while watching the display on the vector network analyzer. He's doing pure tinkering. And by that pure tinkering, you can try
repeater timeout.
By doing pure ham radio-like tinkering, you can test 50 antenna designs in a day. You try to model that wide piece of copper with finite element analysis by CST, a microwave studio, by high-frequency structure simulator. These are, you know, $50,000 computer modeling programs that are very well respected. You try to find that design that way. You will not find it. And each time you change the design and you ask the computer program to remodel it, it'll take you hours of grinding to come up with an answer that is not accurate. You do the real-world tinkering, and the ham radio philosophy, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And you can find that design in a couple of days, as we did and patented it and shipped it, and it's working like a charm. So the equivalent capacitance values, the equivalent inductive values, change as a function of frequency, because you've got very wide pieces of copper. The way the current of the RF energy distributes itself across that wide piece of copper with edge-enhanced movement and lack of current flowing in the center, and those patterns change as a function of frequency. The values are not fixed. You'd be amazed how many people have never seen that. And it has been hidden in plain sight since 1946. Way back in 1946, Mr. Brown and Woodward, I think they worked for Bell Labs, I'm not sure, but what they did is an extremely good experiment. Let me drop. They took a wide sheet of copper, and they made monopole antennas, quarter wave ground plane antennas, so to speak. But they did an experiment where they chose every reasonable length of the radiator, every reasonable diameter of the radiator, and carefully swept it in frequency with their slotted line and their slide rules, and with a whole lot of work, they plotted all that data. They plotted the exact impedance versus frequency of every reasonable length and every reasonable diameter of monopole antenna. And since a dipole is a pair of monopole antennas back-to-back, pair of ground plane antennas back-to-back, if you know what you're looking at when you look at the Brown and Woodward curves that are in Chapter 4 of every edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, they published that article way back in 1946, real measured data. Not somebody's crazy computer modeling program that tries to tell you the way a dipole or a monopole works. And there is a program, there is an equation that everybody uses and they think it's the gospel. It isn't. The real data was on those curves from Mr. Brown and Woodward, and it's been hidden in plain sight all of these years. You look at the bottom of those curves, you suddenly realize that when you've got a very wide radiator, all of a sudden the antenna becomes bandwidth, very, very wide in bandwidth. It becomes very low in Q. People have ignored that section of the chart because they thought low Q represented a high loss and it was undesirable. As a filter network, absolutely true. High Q is desirable, low Q is undesirable. When it comes to an antenna that's built out of materials that are high in efficiency, no I squared R loss in them, low Q is extremely desirable. It makes RFID work. Ain't that crazy? It's been there all this time. And when I go to a lecture of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE,
repeater, timeout.
When I go to an IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society meeting, and I mentioned that curve has been there since 1946 in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, a number of the 20-year seasoned engineers in the room will say, "What chapter was that?" To which I say, "Wow. What rock have they been living under that they didn't realize that stuff has been staring them in the eye all of this time?" Extremely valuable information. It's not modeled information. It's not emulated information. It's the real measured data. Good stuff. Down to the bedrock, if you know what I mean. So the word Q, when it comes to an antenna, it's got a whole lot of crazy, not understood meanings up till now from my point of view. So the fact that somebody can mathematically come up with a concept that if I add a capacitor, I'm increasing the Q, decreasing the Q, or not changing the Q. Let me drop. Depending on what kind of a capacitor, what's the natural Q of the capacitor, where I add it, how I'm using it, if the capacitor is low in quality and I add it to a network, I can lower the Q of the network. If the capacitor is high in quality and I add it to the network, I can raise the Q of the network. If the capacitor is part of an LC network that I'm putting in parallel and it's identical to the original LC network, there will be no Q to the network when I put the two in parallel. So does a capacitor increase the Q, decrease the Q, or leave it alone? Under certain circumstances, the answer is yes, yes, and yes. It can do all of the above depending on how you do it. As usual, there's more to the story than first meets the eye from my point of view. Maybe I've created a lot of confusion, but you're allowed to ask more questions on this one, John. KC2WGB, it's a beauty. K2LAW. And I've made my fortune on this one.
Oh, very good, Dick. Well, like I expressed to you, when I've attempted to put a capacitor, I would see the Q change. But now it's at a different frequency. When I adjust it for proper inductance and played with it to get it back on frequency, the Q is the same. So so I don't think the capacitor has much to do with the cube.
I think the capacitor did have an effect. Did it raise the Q or lower the Q? It's a function of how you use the capacitor. What's the natural Q of the capacitor before you put it in there? Was it in series, in parallel? Were you changing the loading? By the fact that you added a capacitor and it lowered the frequency, that's almost always what happens. And then you added an inductor to bring the frequency back, and now you've got a new resonant network along with the antenna. And the loading of the antenna possibly was the dominant part of the structure, and the LC that you added was the secondary function, off to one side, lightly coupled, so to speak, even though you think you directly connected it across the terminals of the antenna. It may have been a lightly loaded structure. One of the things that you would have found, John, if you carry this experiment further, is that you added an inductor and a capacitor that resonated at the desired frequency. Let me drop. Now, there's an infinite number of ways you can do that. I can choose a very small inductor and a very large capacitor, and I can resonate at your frequency. I can do the opposite. A very large capacitor and a very small inductor and resonate at your frequency. In other words, I'm changing the C to L ratio without changing the resonant frequency. As you do that, you're going to get very different characteristics. And I now remember I was in that exact ballpark way back in the dark ages of 1960 when I built my first very high stability voltage controlled, variable frequency oscillator. I'm building a 6-meter rig with free-running tuning. I didn't want to build a whole bunch of crystals into my 6-meter rig. And I built an oscillator that ran from 9 to 10 megacycles. It's going to be mixed with a 40 megacycle crystal in order to make 50 to 51 megacycles. Maybe it's a 41 meg crystal. 9 to 10 megs was the oscillator. So it ran from the combination of the two when they were mixed, ran from 50 to 51. But what I did, since I was making a transistorized oscillator, let me drop. And I knew that the transistor that's doing the oscillating changed its capacitance as a function of supplied voltage. Almost every transistor, as you increase the voltage across the junction, the amount of capacitance of the transistor decreases. It's a varector diode at the same time that it's a transistor. So I know the transistor is voltage sensitive versus frequency. I know that as the transistor warmed up, its capacitance would change a little bit. So it's temperature sensitive as a function of frequency. I had to use the transistor because I'm building a transistorized oscillator. I was using the best transistor I could get a hold of at the time, RCA 2N384, good to 100 megs. I'm using it at 10 megs. So I'm using a very high quality transistor at its day. And I knew that it still had capacitance variation versus temperature and voltage. Therefore, I knew there would be some drift of that oscillator from the time I turned it on until I warmed it up and used it. I decided to negate that problem. What I did was to choose a great big capacitor and a very small inductor. The great big capacitor on the oscillator was drastically swamping any capacitive effects of the transistor. I literally used a 365 picofarad air variable capacitor, the one that's used in an AM radio that tunes at 1 megahertz. And I'm tuning this thing 9 to 10 megahertz, 10 times higher in frequency. I'm using a 365 picofarad, great big variable capacitor. And across it was a very small inductor made out of 14-gauge wire. So that when that resonator resonated, it had an extremely high C to L ratio. Therefore, the little bit of picofarad change of capacitance of that transistor was extremely minor by comparison. The net result is that that particular voltage variable frequency oscillator, it was a variable frequency oscillator, that voltage control. Let me drop. The net result was that that oscillator had no chirp, no drift, no nothing, if you know what I mean. You could change the voltage you applied to it, you could key the voltage going to that oscillator, and it gave you pure Morse code with no chirp, because the capacitance was so high that what the transistor did didn't matter. And so changing the C to L ratio can have a huge effect on your circuit, even though you would think I went to a lower Q by doing that. Well, I realized that the thing that was changing I didn't have control over was the transistor, and I swapped out the transistor effect and made the most stable oscillator I've ever built that was free. running. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, technique is learned, and that is a wonderful thing about doing the bench experiment.